Oh, yeah, there, yeah, the front, yeah, did see you. And I sort of, told her that sometimes you can do this special chant. It's the Angulimala Pavitta chant. And they asked, can I do this chant for them? I said, no, because sometimes we do that chant, sometimes it's so powerful, the baby comes out straight away. And I've never had a baby being born during a talk. And also, you were saying that that'd be terrible because it's working now again, so I can't finish the story. Yes, I will finish the story. So she said, well, if it comes out, sometimes if it came out here, it may be pointing its feet at the Buddha, and that's supposed to be bad karma. Hopefully you were joking there, because it's only bad karma if you're intentionally supposed to be, you know, doing some way of insulting somebody or something or some culture. But here in this Buddhism, yeah, we do have rituals, we do have cultural stuff. But I don't know if you've ever been in some of these temples in Asia. There's Buddhas all over the place. You can't point your feet anywhere without pointing it at a Buddha. They're all around you. So a lot of time it's not just the actions, but it's just where it's coming from. So that's one of the reasons why we don't have so many rites and rituals in Buddhism. And if there is any rituals, we try and explain them, what they are. So is Buddhism really a religion? And the answer is yes, for tax purposes. But please, if any of you are on the committees of Buddhist societies, don't tell that to the government, otherwise they'll strike you off. But anyway, that's part of Buddhism, that it makes it open to all sorts of other religions or no religions, free thinkers, all sorts of people. Because it's open, it's the meaning behind these things is what's really important. We do have many rituals. Some of those rituals are useful. But this is not a religion of rituals. It's very much a religion of peace and stillness and joy and the lack of stress, a sense of ease. Imagine if you came in here and there were so many rules of what you can wear, what you can't wear, how you should sit, what you should do. Sometimes that would make you feel like someone's always watching you and trying to find fault with you. Whenever I'm sitting here, I'm just very happy that you're here and you're getting something from this. That is something which is being taught, which is easing some of the stress of life. There's already too much stress on you. Isn't it wonderful you can come to a place you can sit comfortably? Again, next to the walls are the best place to sit. They always go first of all. You've been here many times, you know where the best place is. Sitting against the wall there. Maybe we should get some upholstery on the wall. Some padding there for you as well. Because this is actually where we learn how to be kind to our body. Now that's religion to me. How to be kind to your mind. How to be kind to your past. Are all of you saints? Have you never done anything wrong in your past? Have you never done anything which is shameful? I was telling this story to the monks earlier. I told this years ago, here in this hall, at a time when there were some monks in Thailand, but in other countries as well. And these monks, you know, were being found out to not be real monks. They had mistresses. And so, I'm an honest monk. I've always been that way. And so I decided, on a Friday night, I put my head down to make my own confession. It's important to tell the truth, so people know. So I put my head down and I said that some years ago I spent some of the happiest moments of my life, honestly, in the loving arms of another man's wife. We kissed, we hugged, we loved each other. And she was another man's wife. Great you don't remember this. And I said, that before people actually walked outside the door, I said, that woman was my mother. It's my father's wife. I was being honest. In the loving arms of another man's wife. That's true, isn't it? But I said it that way because I wanted people to know how you can add two and two together and make five. That was actually an accurate statement. And I said that purposely to show that how often it is the case we make a judgment and it sounds reasonable, but then it's not. There's another solution to it. And that's an important part of what we do here. How many times you've got a partner in life committed to each other and you split up? Why? Did you really understand the full story of what's going on? When I first said that years ago, there's a few people actually got up from their chairs and they were about to go through the door before I gave the answer. I did nothing wrong. I was a layperson at the time as well. That was my father's wife. Loving arms in the loving arms of another man's wife. My mother. My father's wife. So what we're actually saying there is just be very careful how you make conclusions. Because sometimes that can wreck a marriage. I always say that give other people the benefit of the doubt. Don't judge them harshly. And I've often done that with just overcoming anger or resentment to sometimes what people I feel they've done to me. In the old days, it'd be very easy to get angry at somebody. But I found out when you have anger, what you're actually doing, you're having a little court case in your mind. That person, you know, who's upset you is on trial. And you are the prosecutor and also the judge. When I saw that, that's very unfair. You can't get a truthful verdict without having a defense attorney. So when I saw that, I decided before I get upset or angry about anyone, I would make sure I would deliberately sort of find out reasons for the defense. Maybe they were having a bad day that day, or maybe that's not what they really meant. Or maybe that they were in a bad mood or something. They didn't really mean that. And I did that so many times. Even like with emails. In emails, sometimes you think you're telling the truth in an email. It sounds good to you, but other people read it in a totally different way. And so I notice when it's face-to-face conversations, you can see the reaction in somebody else very quickly. You realize, that's not what I meant. I just said it in the wrong way. I didn't give enough information. But it's easy to feel upset at somebody. And I realize that you're not really judging them fairly. Always have a defense as well as a prosecutor. And whenever there was any sort of misunderstanding in that way, there always was misunderstandings, I always found that I could only give an open verdict. I could never really prosecute anyone. I could never say, you're guilty, you're obviously guilty, you're a bad person. And that's one of the reasons why in all those years when I went to visit prisons and saw some of these people put in jail, when I looked at them, you know, first of all, I was quite scared when I first went into prison. What have they done? Are they murderers? Are they violent? Am I going to be safe in here? But I felt totally safe inside the prisons. Even I saw some prisoners who really were psychotic. And one of the places I went to when I was visiting UK was in Broadmoor. There was the prison hospital for the criminally insane. And one of the people I saw in there was, you know, quite a famous prisoner, you know, one of the Cray twins, Ronnie Cray. Apparently they made a movie about him later on. And, you know, he was notorious. But when you saw him, he shook my hand and said, "How are you?" He was so polite. And also at the end of our short meeting, again, he shook my hand again and said, "When I get a few quid, that's British money, I'll donate it to your monastery." He was in jail, he didn't have any money at all. But there was a lot of kindness there. And this was, you know, a notorious person who was very violent and madly violent. So sometimes it made me not being able to judge anybody. These were really good people sometimes who'd done one bad thing. And it was from that time on I always remembered that there are no such things as criminals. There's no such things as murderers, thieves. There's only people who've done robberies. There's people who've done crimes. That doesn't make them a criminal. They're more than that. And sometimes, you know, you see why they did those things. You find out the reasons behind it. And sometimes, you know, the drugs, peer pressures, making mistakes, making wrong decisions. But sometimes they're much more than the offence for which they've been judged for their life. And sometimes you see that forgiveness and kindness can actually do so much more to help them. Okay, one of the gentlemen, who was one of the people who was organising this birthday fundraising for me, he lives over in Hong Kong, he sent me this really delightful little story. I'm not quite sure even the country it came from, but there was a horse which no one could actually tame, a wild horse. And he decided to give it a try, but not training it by hitting it or starving it or punishing it in any which way, but just being patient and being kind. And of course it took him a long time, but after a while this horse, you know, would allow him to ride on the horse's back. Became like an ordinary horse. People thought it could never be. They used the word broken. That's a terrible word to use, to break a horse. He just used kindness and patience. And this horse, you know, would always, you know, be this guy's friend, would greet him, you know, when he would come home from some other business. He would greet him by actually putting his mouth on the mouth of this owner, would actually kissing him. But then, unfortunately, after so many years, the owner died and passed away. And this guy in Hong Kong, Gerald, sent me this beautiful photograph with the story of when this guy was in the coffin, dead, the horse came up and kissed its friend, kissed the coffin. Obviously, even that horse recognized that this was its friend. I just gave it one last kiss. And this is those sorts of stories. I'm sure you have stories like that as well. Punishment doesn't help. Kindness does. And forgiveness does as well. So all of your past, I'm sure you've got some terrible things which you've done in the past. I've mentioned many of my terrible things. Just giving my mother a birthday present of an eel. I thought that was very funny. It wasn't funny. It was funny to me. My poor mother screamed. And all these other sort of silly things you did, thinking it was funny, but you got it wrong. I wasn't a bad boy. But sometimes you don't realize the effects of what you can do for other people. But one of the things I did notice, my family were always very forgiving, and so was, you know, my teacher Ajahn Chah, always very kind. And even I remember that one of these monks, who was one of the strictest monks in the whole of Thailand, there was this monk called Ajahn Mahabua. He was really strict. And he had this rule in the monastery, they'd only have one meal a day. And you couldn't start eating before he started eating. And when he finished, everybody else had to finish. That's why all those monks, only one meal a day, they always ate very fast. Because sometimes when Ajahn Mahabua stopped eating, then everybody had to. And I remember on this occasion, I'd just gone there for the first time, and I was at the end of the line there, I was eating my lunch. They told me to be fast. And when he finished, everyone had to finish, me too. And I put down my spoon, and he looked at me, and he said, "Carry on eating." Honestly, I was really thin in those days. No skin and bones, because the food which I had in Ajahn Chah's monastery was very, very lack of nutrition, very simple food. And so I was skin and bones. He saw that and he said, "Carry on eating." And that touched my heart. It wasn't I needed to eat more. It was just his kindness. So I carried on eating. And that was the sort of thing which, how? You don't break a monk. You're kind to them. And that is just how they grow and develop. The same to each one of you. You know, I wish I could know you better and just be able to speak to you better, you know, for more personal time, but there's too many of you, only one of me. Try to teach the monks to actually to take those tasks on. But you all know that those of you who've spoken to me, have ever I been critical of you? Always kindness. That works. And that's something, that gentleness which is supposed to come out in the talks and also in the personal things which I can say to you. And it's not just to reassure you, it's to show you how to practice. When you look at your past, what have you done? Please be kind to that. Give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Don't be so self-critical. Because if you do, it means you tend to lose your confidence. When you lose your confidence, you can't do anything much in this world. You lose so many opportunities. You know, one of those wonderful opportunities which you can have and you should take is the opportunity to say sorry. There are some people you live with, you've lived with them for such a long time. You've done things which could have hurt them. And one of the nice things to be able to do is to look at them and say, "You know what I did, please forgive me." And you mean it. And that can be so powerful. That if any of you see any of the ordination ceremonies which we do, and we've done quite a few down at Bodhinyana Monastery recently, just before the start of the rains retreat. And during those ordination ceremonies, one of the parts which I always look forward to, honestly, is when the candidates, usually get their mothers and fathers along as well, they actually bow down to their mum and their dad, give them 3 bows. They've never done that when they were their children at home, working. They bow down to their mum and dad, and they say, "Mum, Dad, whatever I've done over the time you've been my parents since the earliest age, I ask your forgiveness. Things which I didn't do, which I should have done, I'm trying my best. Please forgive me." And you always see, especially the mother, but often the father as well, you'll see tears coming out of their eyes. Because it's sincere, it's honest. They realize they always love their children, but the fact that their children have the guts and the sincerity to say sorry is beautiful. And in all the years which I've been a monk, this is my 48th year as a monk now. I'm sure another couple of years would be 50 years as a monk. I mean, that's, you know, quite sort of a milestone. Don't know why, but anyway, probably is. But in all those years as a monk, sometimes you have met celebrities. And one of those celebrities which I met was actually in Malaysia. She had her own TV show. She was very popular. Sandria, her name was. And I think she still has a TV show somewhere. I hope she's listening to this, because she was getting married in Malacca. And she was amazed that she'd already decided the date and the place of her marriage in Malacca. And it just so happened, by chance, I was teaching a retreat in Malacca that day. And she came up to me and asked, as she sent an email, "Ajahn Brahm, I've been following you for years, and you're teaching a retreat in the place I'm going to get married. Can you please come and give a blessing on my marriage ceremony?" So I talked to the organisers, and we could arrange it, swap a few sort of talks over, and go to a place only 5 minutes away, and then go and give her a blessing, and also a little bit of advice. And let the wedding, with me included, was actually featured on, I think it was New Idea, of one of the big glossy magazines, the Malaysian editions. The first time I got into a glossy magazine. But anyway, that afterwards she wrote this story, a follow-up. She said one of the most amazing pieces of advice she'd got from me on that wedding, what really kept her and her partner together, was I asked them every year on your anniversary have a private dinner or just a cup of coffee together and take turns, it doesn't matter who, just giving each other just little gifts. Nothing expensive. They were wealthy. You can afford it, but don't. Just a tiny gift. And then whoever starts first, tell, you know, your husband, whatever I've done by body, by speech, or by mind, which has hurt you, either intentionally or just by accident, because when we talk, sometimes we're misunderstood, or things I didn't do which I should have done, please forgive me. And doing it honestly, meaningfully, sincerely. If you're not totally sincere about this, you shouldn't do it at all. And then it's the other person's turn to do the same. Anything which I have done by body, speech, or mind, thoughts, words, actions, which have hurt you or embarrassed you, irritated you. I'm a human being, I do make mistakes. Please forgive me as well. And then, what it's doing is you're letting go of all those faults which we can focus on so easily. It destroys our lives. Certainly destroys your relationships. All the kindness, the goodness, the softness, the care which you've shared. A lot of times we don't even recognize or remember that. Just that fault which really ruined our day. I don't know why it couldn't ruin your day. It's only one little thing. But we focus on it, we emphasize it, and we take it out of all proportion. But just so someone can say sorry, I really ask your forgiveness. It's a beautiful thing. She said that kept them together for years, especially those first years when they're getting used to each other. It's a very beautiful thing to do, acts of forgiveness. And that's one of the things which we will do at Bodhinyana Monastery on Thursday, the first day of the Rains Retreat. We resolve to actually stay the 3 months in that particular venue. That's part of a retreat. But you know, there's so many monks and novices and anagarikas there. Even I don't know the final number. And they're still coming, a few of them, like Ajahn Bambali, should be arriving back from Europe in a few days' time. And we have Venerable Lokahita is coming this evening. He's from South Korea. It's an international group of people there. And I love that. It's not just, people I know, or I know them all, but it's a wide range of people. But then first day of the rains retreat, what's one of the parts of the ceremony? We ask forgiveness of one another. Anything which I've done, body, speech, or mind, which may have irritated you or hurt you, things which I said which I shouldn't say, I really am sorry. I don't mean it, but sometimes those things come out of your mouth. And that we have almost like a tradition in Buddhism, if you ask forgiveness, you have to give it. But you know that sometimes people say, but what happens if someone's done something really bad? Doesn't matter, forgive it. Why not? There's so many stories like that, which it takes spirituality to another level. The story of the lady, I read this in a magazine about a year ago, that she was in Auschwitz. She had a twin. So that she was chosen, her and her twin, to be experimented on. That was with Dr. Mengele, I think it was. And she was like the control while her sister was all these terrible experiments on her. Her sister died there. And the one which survived saw it all. Because she was like the control of the experiment, there were twins. The same genes. She survived, but she saw it all. You can imagine what that does to you. Seeing yourself just like a laboratory rat and seeing the people you love being experimented on, like tortured. So you can imagine the anger in her. But then years later, she managed to find one of the doctors. It was only a junior doctor there at the time. But he was one of the people who experimented on her sister. She found him. And she sent this letter to him saying, I know who you are. You killed my sister, tortured her. Please meet me in Auschwitz. They said the time and the date, just a private meeting. And apparently the guy felt so guilty that he went there and met her. And when they met, just the two of them, she said, I forgive you. It was an almost unforgivable act. She said, no, I forgive you. You should never have done that. It hurt me and my sister killed her. But I forgive you. When she wrote that story, she's passed away now, she wrote the story, she said that transformed her from being a victim to being a victor. She transcended, gone past, overcame just the hurt of the past. Because for so many years, that hurt of the past, you can imagine what it does to you. You can't have trust in other people, trauma, PTSD, and also just no happiness. But that forgiveness of someone whom hardly anyone in this world will be able to forgive, freed her. He wasn't interviewed afterwards, I don't know what happened to him. But nevertheless, it's a beautiful thing to do, to give that forgiveness. What was there? Another story of this guy who I don't regularly go through Brisbane. You know, Australia's a big country. And there's many friends I have in Brisbane. I should go there more often if you had the time. But anyway, I was passing through there, and so somebody invited me for the dana. That's my lunch, just me. And I went to their house. And I was just talking before the meal was offered. And then he said, oh, how many children have you got? He said, I've got two. two sons. One was there. So where's the other one? He says, oh, we haven't seen each other for the last 8 or 9 years. They were estranged. And they said, why? He said, well, we just don't get on. And the elder brother was there. So I asked the elder brother, do you know where your brother is? Yeah, he's in town. Do you know his telephone number? I says, yeah, of course I do. So please give him a call on your mobile phone. So the elder brother gave the younger brother a call on the phone. He said, give the phone to me. And I said, this is Ajahn Brahm here. And this was in, I am quite well known. Some people say I'm famous. I don't know if that word is correct. But nevertheless, I do remember some time ago, you know, the head of the Conservative Party here in West Australia, Mike Nahan, some years ago, you know, he came, I think, was the head of multicultural affairs when the Tory government was in power here in Western Australia. And so he came along to one of these Buddhist events, and he went onto the microphone and he said, I just returned from Sri Lanka. And part of going to Sri Lanka, this was many years ago, was climbing up Adam's Peak, Suripada. And he said the guide there was talking to him and said, who are you? And he was a minister in the state government. What state government? West Australia. Oh, do you know Ajahn Brahm? He said, right now, what? And they realized that I was quite well known over there. So, you know, I do have a reputation there. But nevertheless, this was actually, where was I going with this, with the forgiveness? That's the trouble when I go into another story. I get in, I don't plan these talks, okay? They really are off the cuff. And that's an important part. You know, I give so many talks, and you know, sometimes you're very busy. Even Amoka, he just asked me, he said, I don't know how you do this. And sometimes I don't. I just sit here, no plans at all, and start opening my mouth, and this is what comes out. Now, where was this coming from? It's gone on another sort of angle. Even when I do the guided meditation, the phone. Oh yeah, thank you. So I said, this is Ajahn Brahm here. Ajahn Brahm. You know, I was a famous monk in this guy's idea. Said, I'm in your father's house for a dana. Please come over now. And I hung up. He didn't have a chance to object. And he also realized, because I was a well-known monk, it's a bit dangerous, you know, not to follow my orders. I don't have any power over him at all, but he thought that. So I made use of that situation. So he came over, and I got him to sit right next to his father. His father was looking this way, the son was looking the other way. They wouldn't even look at each other. But they were sitting there because I ordered them to. Then I asked the father, what happened? 8 years ago, why have you just lost contact with your son for all these years? And his father answered, I can't remember. And so I asked the son, his strange son, why haven't you seen your father? I can't remember either. That was weird. I don't know if that's always the case, but when you get upset at somebody, why? In that case, this was true, I'm being accurate, that they were estranged and neither could remember why. Even if you do remember, it's not a good reason. Never is. And so I say, okay, it's enough. So you look at each other. You know, you've got blood relations, father and son. Okay, and let's put an end to this now, which they did. And it's very good for Bodhinyana Monastery. I know we had an executive meeting earlier about how to raise funds for Bodhinyana Monastery or the city centre here. And so they gave us a big donation afterwards. Imagine that's your son, or that's your father. You haven't seen each other for years. And to get some monk come up and just solve the problem. That's a beautiful thing. Okay, I mean, you can win the lottery, but win your family back. That's something which is far more powerful. And they forgave each other. They didn't really understand what they were forgiving each other for. They forgot over all those years. Just, I don't go to my dad's house, I don't go to my son's house. And that was a beautiful thing to see. Not caring about the donation, but caring that, you know, you could somehow or other, you know, use, you know, your authority, whatever that is, to actually bring people together, help people. All it takes is a tiny bit of forgiveness. It's not much. There's another case, good they're not here, but it was husband and his wife, and she was just cleaning his jacket at home, looked inside the jacket pocket, and there was a receipt in there for one of the brothels in Perth. She called him out. He was actually visiting prostitutes. And she was so upset, right, that's it, divorce. But they were both Buddhists, so they came to the temple, Bodhinyana Monastery. And they have to be sincere with me, so I talked with them. And I said, did you do that? He said, yes, I'm really sorry, I shouldn't have done. I made a mistake. And the interesting part was I asked him, do you still love your wife? He said, yes, I really do. Why do you do that? I don't know, but I still love her. And I asked her, what do you think? She said, I can't trust him anymore. It's all over. And when I looked at both of them, you know, I actually trusted both of them. I said, will you ever do that again? He said, no, honest. He said that in front of me, in front of the big Buddha statue. Can you forgive him, give him another chance? He said, no, that was just too bad. If he does it once, he'll do it again. So we took the forgiveness to the next level. I said, this is something we do in Western countries. Can you grant him parole? What parole means is, yeah, you're not going to divorce him yet, but you give him this possibility of forgiveness, maybe 1 year on. But he has to make sure he gives you all the passwords to his mobile phones, computers, any sort of bank accounts he has, you can have a look at them, so you can find out that he's keeping his promise to be faithful to you. It took me such a long time to convince her to do that. But she did. And 1 year later, he kept a very clean slate. They had this wonderful relationship to each other. He realized how lucky he was that she could forgive him, but she had to have confidence he was worth forgiving and that he was trustworthy. So he had to open himself up completely, all his records, and answer her questions, you know, with evidence if necessary. So we'd never do that again. And I'm very happy with that because they come to our monastery every week. I think it's out of gratitude. You kept their marriage together. And little things like that I didn't. I just gave them the way to keep it together and how powerful forgiveness is. You know, when you don't trust anybody, they do usually, you know, they live up to what you expect and they're naughty, they don't behave. But when you give somebody trust, and you really give them trust, even with parole, it's amazing just how that raises people up. Even last week when I said over at Bodhinyana Monastery, Rains Retreat, there's a lot of monks there and there's a lot of duties to be done. And so we usually have rosters, and so somebody spends hours working out rosters, who's going to clean the toilets, who's going to sweep the roads. And I said, no, let's have no rosters. Put up the job there's jobs there which need to be done, and people can volunteer. If they don't volunteer, fine. They're not going to be forced to do any jobs. Total volunteer. And I was just so pleased. All these years I've been teaching these monks, some young monks, some more mature monks, but the first time, no rosters. And the list we put up of people, who the jobs would need to be done, they all got volunteers the first day. They're all in there, just filling it all out. You trusted them. And they exceeded my trust only one day. So that's a very beautiful, when you have a monastery like that, I'm very happy to be there. You don't have to tell people what to do. They volunteer to do that. That kindness, that service, that wanting to help out, that type of attitude, that joy, shows me their meditation is getting really good. Because the meditation, don't force meditation. I get sometimes people question me about this. You mean you just sit there and you just trust the mind as a passenger? I said, yes. It's impossible, you have to do something, make some sort of resolution. Decide to watch the breath or decide to do something else. Keep all those defilements away. No. I've done this demonstration so many times, but it fits in now. The water in this cup, how can I hold this still? Mindfulness doesn't work. It's still moving. Concentration. I'm really aware, I'm trying. It doesn't become still at all. How does this become perfectly still? You put it down. It's moving more now, but be patient. And if you're patient, you trust. I trust this water to become still, because that's the nature of gravity. When I look at that, that water is so still, I could never hold it that still. That's how meditation works. If you have to hold it still, you get tired. You can only do that for a time. If you put it down, let it go, it becomes still so easily, so beautifully. That's why the joy of meditation builds up. It's something which is really spiritual. Yes, you have to work, do your jobs, do your chores, but there comes a time when you just let go and you trust. And when you have that trust, life becomes so much easier. You're not afraid, you're not run by fear. Our world is often run by fear. Fear of losing your job. Fear of getting COVID, fear of people not liking you, fear of people not enjoying your talk. I gave up a long time ago. You like it, you don't like it. I'm not afraid. Because of that, giving up fear, you can let go and things become peaceful. The talks become beautiful and helpful and inspiring. That's their nature when you get out of the way and let them happen. And honestly, I never give a talk. I really mean that. I don't give talks. I just get out of the way and let it happen. That's why you can give, you know, it's not just a talk on a Friday night, so many talks a week. The last talk I gave was yesterday morning. That was a talk to the United States. Because, you know, yesterday morning was actually Wednesday evening in the US. A nice talk. You know the best part of that talk, I must admit, at the very end of the talk, the host sort of said, oh, usually our organization, you know, you've helped us, that we give a donation. So all the donations collected today, we're going to give 60% to your organization, the BSWA, and 40% for our organization. I said, no, I don't agree with that split. I said 100% to your organization, nothing to me. It's just a joy to give talks, not getting anything out of it. Please excuse me, BSWA representatives, you didn't make any money out of that. But you get so much joy out of it. And people say, yeah, that's Dana. That's generosity. And it's wonderful that I can practice that generosity as well, as I've done to you tonight and done to you for the last 9 months giving talks on Friday nights. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for listening. Excellent, thank you. Okay, so we've got any questions from the floor? From any of you people here? Okay, we've got some questions online for sure. And if you do need a talk during the time when the monks and nuns don't come here, please remember there's hundreds of talks online. Whatever you want to listen to, it's been mentioned. Buddhism and coffins. That's one of the talks I remember giving. Buddhism and bananas. They're online there somewhere. Anyway. From Melissa. Please can you speak about loneliness on a spiritual path? As I let go of attachments, I feel less in common with people who used to be my friends and causes I used to care about. A male in Australia. That loneliness, if you like yourself, if you're friends with yourself, if you enjoy your own company, you never ever feel lonely. And I say my own 6 months personal retreat, which I did a few years ago, for those 6 months, I never saw a human being, never talked to a human being. That's honest. Just people would put food in a box and I would go and pick it up later. Eat it, wash the bowl and put the bowl back in the box. For 6 months I never saw anybody. There was no telephone or email or anything. It was total solitude. I love that. And the reason was that I am my best friend. So when I'm with myself, I just sit down or rest if I need to rest. Chant if I want to chant, read or whatever, and I'm kind to me. My body and I are so close. We're best friends. We're mates. I'm not afraid of me. I don't criticize me. And just the way that I was meditating with you. Feet, how are you? Knees, how are you doing? I'm kind to my body. So my body is kind to me, and my mind, yeah, I make mistakes or do silly things, but I forgive those, I laugh at them, and I share them with you. It's a wonderful way of living, not embarrassed. I know everyone makes mistakes, but I let you know them. We laugh together, and that means it makes me human, makes mistakes, but you forgive them. You're not afraid of yourself. Which means you love yourself in a beautiful spiritual way. So you're at peace. So give me 3 months of solitude. Oh my goodness, I'd love that. Unfortunately, those 3 months of the Range Retreat, for 2.5 of those months, I'll be teaching the other monks. But I still have 2 weeks. It's my holiday. Where would you like to go for the most perfect holiday in the world? For me, it's my cave. People bring me food, and I just have plenty to eat. You can stay in there as long as you want. Just meditating. And I don't decide to do something. Years ago, I remembered, all I need to do is just go in there and relax to the max. And then the mind by itself goes into these beautiful states of mind. You have wonderful fun. I'm just looking forward to my retreat now. To Kiran. Dear Ajahn, should we help ourselves first, get enlightened, and then help others, or should I take up the opportunity where I can help myself and others by being a meditation teacher? It's from India. Look, would you allow yourselves to be operated on by somebody who's not a doctor? Wouldn't it be better actually to become a doctor first before you do operations? Wouldn't it be better to become enlightened first, at least to be a stream winner, before you teach others? Who would you like to operate on you? If it was you and you had the opportunity, you'd get the best surgeon in Perth. If you can't get a good surgeon in Perth, you'd go overseas, and if you got the money, and get someone in even Bangkok or Singapore or something, do this therapeutic medical tourism. Because this is your body, you want the very best. So if you want a meditation teacher, who do you want to get? Someone who doesn't know how to meditate? Someone who doesn't really know what enlightenment is, what kindness is, what forgiveness is? What would you want? So you decide to please, don't just become a meditation teacher when you don't know what you're really talking about. Really get in there and become qualified. Who can qualify you? Only you know whether you're at peace. You know what you're doing. You have to be honest. And then, when you're honest, then you find you can really help people. Oh, this is a nice name, Rainbow Zebra. Dear Ajahn, my mum says, I don't like Buddhas because they think sick, suffering people have done something to deserve it in a past life. That is not true. Should I respond to that? No, sick or suffering people need some help. They need doctors, but not just doctors of the body, doctors of the mind as well. That's why where the mindfulness tradition started, John Kabat-Zinn realized so many people just are so anti some religions that, you know, if you said this is Buddhist, many of the hospitals over in United States wouldn't even let them in. So by making it sound non-religious, just calling it mindfulness, and taking away the other part of Buddhism from it, then they could get actually much more traction in the hospitals. He did that, and actually made mindfulness so strong in our world. But, you know, it is basic Buddhist practice. But anyway, that's what Buddhists give to the world. They don't just, that's almost like an excuse, not a reason. They think sick, suffering people have done something to deserve it in a past life. We also think that happy people, healthy people, people who have a lot of success in their life, that you've done something to deserve that. But not just in past life, in this life. You've had a good attitude. You sacrificed a lot, say, to be a doctor or, you know, to be a owner of a business or something. You've worked hard. And if you've done really well, I mean really well, by not exploiting other people, by being a kindly business, that's the very best. I still mention that some businesses are kindly. And one of these businesses I often quote, it's a long time ago now, but it was a company called Farrelly and Sons. And they had a business maintenance, or building maintenance company in the UK. And they won the business prize that year. In 1 year, they had trebled their turnover, doubled their profits, or something like that, amazing results, by just doing a very simple business strategy. And that strategy was banning overtime. At the end of the 38 hours or 40 hours, whatever it was, you had to go home. And you couldn't take work home with you. You worked in the office or in the company, this was pre-COVID times, and that's all you did. End of the day, out of here, go home. Because they realized you have families. You don't have families, you've got your social life. It's important you have time for that. And if anyone is sick, you get your sick leave. What that actually meant was people, imagine you worked for a company like that. You do your 38 hours or whatever it is a week, and that's all. And you're banned from doing more than that. You'd love to work for a company like that. You'd love to be a committee member of a Buddhist society who enforces that. because it's caring for you, realizing there's more to your life than just the business or the work. And what that meant, that the turnover of staff went to close to zero. Nobody wanted to get rid of their jobs and go and apply for another job. The job satisfaction was way up in the stratosphere. And also, the people really wanted to make sure that company was successful. It was just a little attitude of caring for their staff. When everybody cared for one another, had huge increase in productivity. Everyone was healthier, happier, could spend time with their kids, could rest at night. And I often mention this, one of the biggest reasons for depression, cancer, so many other illnesses, people don't get enough rest. Do you get enough rest? Put your hands up if you could always do with a bit more rest. I'll put my hand up as well. I'm taking the rest soon because it's a rage retreat. And that's what we do it for our health of body and mind. And when you're allowed to do that, imagine just your productivity. It's a much happier monastery when you let people trust them to go and take a rest. So anyway, that is actually how Buddhists behave, or they should behave. That's how I try and make sure we behave. Last question, or not quite, there's another question afterwards. My partner calls you the lovely monk who hasn't still learned to wear the robe properly. My question is, why don't the monks upgrade what you wear to something more comfortable? This is comfortable. That's why I wear it this way. If I straighten up the robe, it becomes uncomfortable. What is proper? Wearing a robe. This is proper enough for me. I am rebellious. I've always been rebellious, not doing things which other people do or say, to making sure you understand what is the purpose of the robe. This is something which we chant. It's actually for covering up your private parts, which seeing it might offend others, for keeping you cool in the hot weather, keeping you warm in the cool weather, only for the maintenance of your bodily health, keeping away mosquitoes and gadfly and flies and stuff. That's what the purpose of the robe is. It's not a fashion statement. It's how it's comfortable. Why do the monks upgrade you? A lot of times I forbid them from upgrading me. My robe should be no better, no worse than all the other monks' robes. Although that sometimes my robe does get upgraded without my consent. When I went to a fundraiser in Melbourne, I think it was a year ago or a couple of years ago, when I went there, one of the monks, his Venerable Ajahn Mudito, he took my robe and pulled it off me. He gave me another robe so he could auction my old robe. I didn't know what he was up to. But of course you give consent because it was an act of kindness for others. So that's where sometimes my robe gets lost because it gets auctioned off. And sometimes that, you know, many of these auctions and fundraisers, it's not the worth of the robe, it's not getting a bargain. It's almost an excuse. Have a bit of fun and also to raise funds for something. A lot of times whatever funds are raised, you know, sometimes it's say a robe, and whoever wins that robe, they give it to somebody else. So it can be auctioned twice on the same night. And it's not the idea of money purchasing stuff. It's just an excuse for giving, for making sure this is for a retreat center. We've got a beautiful retreat center in Jhana Grove, which I insist is always for free. You can give a donation afterwards, but if you don't give a donation, you can't afford it, you can still go in there. That's important for me to make sure it's free. Same with this place. We never have charging people to come in here or charging people to go out. This is all for free. And that's just, and we do really well that way, inspiring people, not by charging people. So that's actually why we do things this way. Just silly things. You know, I've got this little teddy bear I was talking about earlier. It's only a tiny bear, but it's so cute. So you know what the reserve price for that little bear is? $1,000. And I'm sure that somebody will buy that and they'll give it back again and they'll auction it twice or three times. Just an excuse for making a donation to a retreat centre later on. It's just excuses. Anyway, there's quite a few. Look, I just do one more. Stefano Grillo, he's coming to the retreat. You've seen him a few days. Robert Laubscher. Hello, Ajahn. Do you teach the Mahasi style noting meditation? Somebody from Melbourne. No, I don't teach that. And one of the reasons, okay, it's a funny story. You deserve a funny story. There was this lady, and she lived in a very expensive house, and she had even a guard on her house because many robbers were stealing, burglaring from expensive houses. And she came to this monastery, and she told her guard, please be aware of the burglars. You've got to be alert because I don't want these burglars to burgle my house. He said, you know, I am aware. I go to these Vipassana tradition meditations. I know what to do. I'll be very aware. And so when the owner of the house went back home, she found her home had been burgled. Everything had been stolen. I told you to be mindful and aware. You know, stupid guard. I said, madam, I was very aware. I saw the burglars going in and I noted burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw jewellery going out and I noted jewellery going out, jewellery going out, jewellery going out. I saw them backing a van into your house and I saw safe going out, safe going out. I was very mindful. I was noting all the time, madam. It's not just about noting. Sometimes it's a response necessary, some restraint to make the mind really peaceful, to safeguard your belongings. And what do you really own? Peace, stillness, joy. Don't let anybody burgle that. Dear Ajahn, the guy I like doesn't like me back. How can I make up my mind to move on and be happy? I know that I should let go of that attachment. It's practically very difficult. Please advise. Look, there's no way in the world that anybody cannot like you. They sometimes don't like you. There's some parts of you which I'm sure are of them, of you, of everybody, which is really nice. It was very difficult for me sometimes to understand why some of those BASTRDS, which really ruined my life when I was young, why other people like them. How can you have, you know, some of these people, you know, other people like? You know, some of these politicians, I can't say who they are, but you know, that some of them have done some really bad things, and how can other people like them? And that was really hard for me to understand. All of the people you may find really bad people you don't like at all, they have wives, husbands, parents, children who really love them and see the nice side of them. Are they all bad or have they got good qualities which some people can see and you can't? And even, you know, one of the persons which people say was the most evil person in the world, Adolf Hitler. Would you agree on that? Have a look in the book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, and you see a poem written by Adolf Hitler. You read it first, and then see what the name is, the author, and his love for his mum. It's a beautiful poem. And I put that in that book simply because you can't believe that that was written by the person who authorized the Auschwitz camps, who was responsible for killing so many people. but loved his mum to bits. That challenges our judgments of people. You don't support what he did over there, but certainly had this beautiful side of his love for his mother. If your mother asks and asks again and asks again, never respond with anger, always respond with love, because there will come a time when your mother will ask no more. She'll have passed away. That was one of the passages in his book. So basically, I've never seen a person in this world you can't forgive and see the lovely side of them for. I mean, if somebody died, I always say this about Adolf Hitler, if I was, you know, some god in heaven and I was deciding where people would get reborn, and this guy came up with a little moustache and it was Adolf Hitler, and he said, where do I have to go? You're going to send me to hell, aren't you? I said, no, I can't send anyone to hell. Why would you actually punish anybody? It doesn't make sense to me. I said, listen, we're going to send you up to heaven as well, but I'm going to shave off that moustache, do a new hairstyle, and just make sure you can't lift up your hand too high. I'll give you another name. So you still go to heaven, but under a different name, under disguise, because some people won't understand. But you can still go to heaven and have some happiness. And maybe there, meeting good people in heaven, that will change the way you looked at life. Anyway, I'm not God, so I won't do that. How to fall in love with my husband? I love my husband, but I have never felt butterflies in my stomach. How to fall in love with my husband? Is that what love means, eating butterflies? What you need to do is eat, you know, the larva from which the butterfly comes. Eat, what's that called? It's larva, isn't it? Eat the larva first. Ah, they have larva cake, don't they? Eat larva cake, and then the butterflies will come up later on. There's many forms of love. I said that's one of the books which I, one of the talks which I gave. I think the four types of love. That was a very popular talk. But don't judge love with your brain. Feel it with your heart. And don't sort of, and you know what it feels like. Express it in your own way. Okay. What should I do when I already apologize to the person I love, if she does give me the chance to listen to me and walked away when I'm still in grief of my lost family? If she doesn't forgive you yet, give her forgiveness again. Someone asked me, how many times should you forgive? And the answer is always one more time. Which means there's no limit. Always one more time. After a while, the forgiveness wears you down. It has to be sincere. And it's no strings attached, not asking for anything back in return. Just give, forgive. Oh my goodness, it's still going. From Borneo. How do you get your body and mind sync, like when you feel physically not happy where you live? Your body is here, but thoughts are running around. How do we stop comparing as well? You're in Borneo. I've been to Borneo before. It's a beautiful country. So see the beautiful part of it. Don't just look at the old two bad bricks in the wall. Every country's got two bad bricks. If you look at those, you don't like to live there at all. Look at the beautiful part. And you see the beautiful part. If you left Borneo and you went somewhere else, then you'd miss Borneo. There used to be these, because, you know, I came from Thailand, used to be these Thai people who'd come to Perth, and then they get homesick for Thailand. So they go to Thailand, and they say they came back here because they were homesick for Perth. They didn't know where they belonged. Wherever you are, that's good enough. Okay, the last question. When I finished meditation, my legs felt so numb, and I felt pain in my vertebral column. What to do when this happens? someone from Sri Lanka. When that happens, just make sure you check your posture next time. Sit on a chair. Say, no, 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 I want to get enlightened. You can only get enlightened sitting full lotus on the ground. That's not true. Find a comfortable position for your body. So, over here, it was just, I think last week, look at that chair over there. Isn't that a lovely chair to sit on? So instead of sitting over there, which is passé, you go and get the cushions and the chair or something. Look, I don't mind as long as it's necessary and you're comfortable. So in, this is from Sri Lanka, when you finish meditating and your legs feel so numb, it means you didn't look after your posture well enough when you started. So sit on a chair, get more cushions or something. Remember, the Buddha was always compassionate. So find that middle way. That was the first teaching the Buddha gave on Asalha Puja Day. That's the full moon on Wednesday. The first teaching he ever gave was, please avoid the extremes of having a posture where you create pain in your body. You never get peace or enlightenment or anything that way. Make sure your body's comfortable. That's why I don't mind, honestly. You can actually push your legs out and point it at me and the Buddha. Great, you have my full permission to do that if it's comfortable. And that's actually, the comfort is more important than the rules and regulations and traditions. The main tradition is the comfort. The comfort so your body can disappear totally. So you don't feel the body at all, just in the mind, blissing out, having a wonderful time. And again, your vertebral column. Make sure that you begin with, I stretch my back at the beginning so it feels in a good position, and I never feel any pain in my back that way. There was one time, for those of you who've been around a long time, I think Dennis may remember this, ex-president a long time ago. I was busy just laying concrete for the wall at Bodhinyana Monastery. The concrete was going off really fast. I had to keep bending over to smooth out the concrete. And afterwards, I couldn't straighten my back. I really injured it. About 2 or 3 months, I was bent over like an old person, like an old farmer's. It took me a long time to heal that, but I healed it just, through the yoga position, the cobra, yeah. And it was brilliant. Can I really feel my back and stretch it just the right amount? I never had any problem with my back ever since. So I know just how injuries are. You notice, you look after, you become mindful of your body, especially your back. You don't have any pain anymore there. So anyway, be kind to your body. Don't just think you get fully enlightened by enduring pain. Just pain makes you sick. Pain is the body's warning to you that you're not doing things properly. And for those of you who are traditional Buddhists, where did the Buddha sit meditation to become enlightened? In this beautiful, under this beautiful tree, a shady tree, not out in the sun, in a place where there wasn't many mosquitoes or flies. He got a cushion under his backside by getting some grass. He had this beautiful meal, which was actually cooked for a heavenly being. This lady Sujata made this offering. It was supposed to be offering for a heavenly being, but saw the Buddha there and gave it to him instead. Beautiful meal and a quiet place next to the river Narangali. It was a park. Beautiful sort of winds, water. It was like paradisical. That's one of the reasons why don't think you're going to make it to enlightenment by sitting on broken glass, enduring pain for hours, thinking that's going to make you enlightened. It's going to make you tough. But it's always going to make you frustrated when you find it doesn't work. Get your body comfortably enough so it can be alert without any pain. And then the mindfulness can go inside to your mind and get blissed out. Okay, thank you for those questions. We've gone on longer than usual, but it is the last time I'm going to be here for a while. So thank you all for staying. A lot of people here, it's amazing. So now we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And then any more questions, you can come up here.
Arahaṃ sammāsambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno bhagavato savaka sango sangang namami.
Oops. Okay, don't bow to me. Just bow.
I don't.
Yeah, people bow to you. You've got to get used to that.